Today, reporter Damien Gale has spent a week with Extinction Rebellion, and environment correspondent Matthew Taylor tells us how realistic their demands really are.
Well, I always do the protests, though, for The Guardian.
Is that kind of your patch?
It's kind of my patch. And if a protest goes off and I don't get to cover it, then I feel a little bit kind of aggrieved.
Did you expect to be spending 7 days down there?
No, not really. No. It's like nothing I've ever seen. I've never seen anyone hold four spots of central London for 5 days and then have a kind of protest festival atmosphere at each one.
Guardian reporter Damien Gale spent last week with climate activists Extinction Rebellion. They've described themselves as the biggest civil disobedience campaign in British history.
Coming up on tonight's programme, with climate change protests in their second week and
the seemingly mostly middle-class eco-activist temper tantrum known as Extinction Rebellion came to London.
They are the new protest group asking thousands of people to break the law. Extinction Rebellion is fighting climate change and has been making headlines over the last few months.
The protests have lasted 10 days and there have been over 1,000 arrests. When Parliament returned from recess on Tuesday, Labour MP Ed Miliband called an urgent question in the Commons.
First, will she seek to persuade the Prime Minister to declare a climate emergency, as many local authorities have done, to focus minds across government on the centrality of this issue?
Today, the group are planning to wind down their protests across London. For now. The protesters have raised the profile of the climate crisis beyond all expectations. But who are they?
Extinction! Rebellion!
Extinction! Rebellion!
And could they be about to change the course of history? From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesim. Today in Focus, a week with Extinction Rebellion. So Damien, lay out a map for us of the protest that basically brought London to a standstill last week. What happened?
On Monday, activists from Extinction Rebellion occupied four spots in central London. So around Marble Arch, it was the climate crisis area. And then Oxford Circus, they brought in a big pink boat. It was named after Berta Cáceres, who is a Honduran eco-activist who was murdered.
And the boat was about the truth, wasn't it?
Yeah, all the sites were based around different tenets of their ideology. So yeah, Oxford Circus was tell the truth, and it was that because it's down the road from the BBC, and they want to see more coverage of the climate emergency. From there, south was Waterloo Bridge, which they cheekily turned into a garden bridge. And they brought on potted plants and trees and a stage. And then there was Parliament Square as well, which was supposed to be a kind of a space for experiments in new kinds of democracy, new kinds of participatory democracies. They were going to have people's assemblies down there.
Oh, there's a massive cutout here of David Attenborough hanging out underneath a dinosaur.
I mean, you were there all week. I was kind of surprised when I went down on Saturday that it felt sort of quite quiet. You know, it didn't feel like ram-packed streets. It did feel quite different.
Well, I think the remarkable thing about the strategy that they've devised is that they don't actually need a lot of people to cause really serious disruption, because they've got so many people who are willing to be arrested. And I think they gave a figure of 2,000 at the beginning of the week that they'd signed up who were willing to be arrested. They can use these, as they call them, arrestables, to really gum up any attempt by the police to clear the area.
All right, I'm going to arrest you, okay, for breach of Section 14 of the Public Order Act 1986 for failing to move on when requested or when required, okay?
Each one of the four sites was protected essentially by a human barricade of people who were willing to sit down in the path of any advancing formation of police, lock themselves together with lockboxes, glue themselves to the pavement, even glue themselves to each other. As much as the police could arrest people. For every one person they were arrested at some points, two more people were turning up and taking their place. For each person who's arrested, four people have to carry that person away. Then one officer has to go with them to the police station in order to process them. They can only fit three prisoners in each police van.
So it's about police time.
It's about police time, and I think that's what they've really that's where they've tested the limits, and that's really how they've managed to keep going for so long.
They have three very specific demands, don't they? What are they?
Okay, so their first demand is for the government to tell the truth.
Tell the truth about what is happening.
They say that the government has not really been honest about the true implications of climate change, and they cite some really frightening science that's come out over the past couple of years, particularly the IPCC report that says that I think that we've got 12 years to stop catastrophic runaway climate change. Their second demand is for the government to institute citizens' assemblies. It's essentially an exercise in radical participatory democracy, because they say that the political system that we currently have is not fit for trying to tackle a problem like this. And their third, and I suppose most radical demand, is that they're calling for the economy to be completely transformed to carbon zero by 2025. So that would be no CO2 emissions at all.
In 6 years.
In 6 years, yeah.
One of the targets of the protest was the headquarters of the oil company Shell. And a real moment for me last week was seeing the internationally renowned lawyer, a woman called Farhana Yamin. And she's also one of the lead authors on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. And she glued herself to the floor.
Stop lobbying government to delay action. Please prove to me that the legal process is pretty broken right now.
That's right, yeah, she stuck herself to the pavement in front of the Shell building, and this was the day after five other activists had stuck themselves to the doors of the same building, smashed a window, smeared it with spray chalk graffiti.
And it was really moving, actually, the footage of her being taken away. She was, her husband was there and her 9-year-old son.
And the fact that she's willing to make herself arrested, or get herself arrested, proves that she is so fearless that she will do anything to make people listen and care about what's going on.
And actually, I have to say, I felt being down there the whole day was quite emotional. I met one woman who really struck a chord in me. Her name was Hannah, and she was one of the last protesters at Oxford Circus, and she was locked into one of these metal tubes, and she was 7 months pregnant.
What happens next when they arrest you?
I've never been arrested before, so I don't know. I'm just a law-abiding citizen.
She also had a little photo of a kid sticking out of her top.
Hannah, can I just ask, who's this?
And when I asked her about that,
of a kid sticking out of your top.
Yeah, it was clearly very hard for her to talk about what was happening.
She's Ellen, my daughter Ellen.
Why does that make you tearful?
It's for her. We have to wake up and realise that our kids won't have a future.
During your time covering the protests, you went to the headquarters in London to meet one of the co-founders.
Usually for the media, I use Dr. Gail Bradbrook, just for the old boys network to back off. Don't put that in.
She told me that she had been trying to find ways to bring about social change for quite a long time, and that she'd done a lot of research and personal work, and even travelled to Costa Rica. And she says she prayed for the codes for social change. When she returned, she met Roger Hallam, who is kind of the theorist and the strategist behind what it is that Extinction Rebellion are doing. And she told me she had a long meeting with him. And at the end of that meeting,
he told me that he'd just given me the codes for social change. So that was a bit strange, but also very beautiful.
So Gail and Roger, they meet quite a few times. They start to cook up what might be a way of bringing this to the fore? And then what happens? When does it really start to get traction?
Gosh, well, I mean, I suppose when it really starts to get traction is October is when they read out the Declaration of Rebellion, and in November when they carried out their first actions.
Protesters have blocked off 5 major bridges in central London.
They didn't have a lot of activists at that point, but what they did have is they had tremendous resolve and had these people who were completely willing to be arrested, which is not something that I've ever seen in protest before. Generally, when you see people in protest who are trying to cause disruption or commit disruptive acts, you know, someone will run up with a mask on, smash the window of an estate agent or something, and then run off. And they have a completely different ethos. They say, if you're going to commit an act in the name of Extinction Rebellion, then you have to take responsibility for it. So if you're going to go up and you're going to smash that window, then you're going to have to stand next to it afterwards. And as the police come, you have to tell them, you know, why it is that you've done it and why you've chosen that particular location for doing it. And then you have to be arrested.
As they're going along, do you feel like, you know, as they're developing what the movement is, are they kind of looking to the past? Are they bettering previous protests?
Yeah, so most of the people who were involved in the core of Extinction Rebellion are protest veterans. A lot of them were involved in the Occupy protests. They've learnt the mistakes from those. One of the mistakes of those protests is, I think, that when people started using alcohol and drugs, then that kind of soured the atmosphere around those protest camps. And so that's probably what lies behind. They're quite strict restrictions on those kind of things. When there are parties going on, you know, you see the Extinction Rebellion people walking through the crowd and just politely asking people who are drinking, you know, can you put that away? Or can you go and finish that outside and come back when it's done? And according to Gail Bradbrook, it's very much part of how it is that they work. They don't feel that they've come in with a master plan which they're going to execute every single point of. Actually, each thing is an experiment, and then they come out and stage an action. They then go away and they think, well, what's worked? What hasn't worked? How can they do the same thing again next time with more effect, or do they need to completely rethink?
And how did people feel when the sites were cleared? So Waterloo Bridge was cleared on Sunday, Oxford Circus as well.
I think people were disappointed, but I got the impression from Gail and some of the other organisers that I spoke to that actually they were slightly surprised that they'd lasted as long as they had. So they were pleased as punch.
Everything that we've done has gone so much better than my expectations, and I feel incredibly grateful that we've managed to get Brexit out of the news. I'm sure it's not out of the news, but you know what I mean.
We've had a 0.4% decrease in emissions since 1990. We have to have drastic...
Went on the Today programme, which was relatively intimidating, but it was OK.
When the situation...
Now, does gluing yourself to a train highlight that as against having a parliamentary debate or David Attenborough?
It gets you on the Today programme, Nick.
Well, it gets you on the Today programme in order to be asked why you're disrupting people's lives, not to talk about climate change. We talk about that all the time.
No, sorry, but you don't, to be honest, because if we were treating this as the emergency that it is, it would be on the news absolutely every single day.
You know, Nick Robinson made this comment that obviously they cover climate change. It's just like that when you say that, you're not getting this thing.
Something that I've been increasingly interested in is the image of climate change protests and the way that we talk about it.
Sorry, your name?
Billy.
I did stop a couple of guys who were passing by who were really interesting. They're called Jack and Billy.
I agree with the cause, but I don't agree with how it's being done. It's a massive disruption. It's going to cost a lot of money.
They were like just sort of like lads are from Leicester, just passing by. And it was quite interesting because they were saying, oh, it's so annoying, and they were calling them hippies. But they actually had this kind of sense that, well, maybe we just need the hippies to kickstart it all, and we've needed that all along, and it was always going to come from here.
Actually, that's a good point to make, actually. That's the good thing that's come out of this, it's raised awareness of what's happening, really.
Thanks, guys. So, overall, would you say more annoyed or more, like, welcoming? Be honest.
Annoyed in a good way.
What sort of a sense did you get walking around the protests of like how the protests are being perceived?
I think there's still a sense that there's a real eco-warrior vibe. And I think, yeah, as you said, it was always going to come from that place. There's always going to be those people who care the most about climate change who were going to kick this off and who were going to be the organising principle. And you saw a few people going through the area who really weren't impressed. One of the things that really annoys people is when they go out and stop traffic. So one guy told me he'd been punched in the chest by a motorist who was furious that he'd been stopped in traffic.
Member public started swearing, calling me a hippie, saying that I'm a benefit cheat, etc, etc. I kept smiling, trying to explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. He's then gone and punched me full on in the chest in front of police officers with cameras.
On the other hand, I think, you know, a lot of people have been won over by what's happening. And I particularly saw a shift in the kinds of people who were involved compared to back in November, when it was very much more of a hardcore. November seemed to be almost like the trailer for what's happening now this Easter. And this time, you know, I've seen a much broader coalition of people get involved. People who you wouldn't necessarily expect to be involved in a climate protest. I met these two guys who were self-proclaimed capitalists, who were fund managers, and they invested their own money into buying, I think, 5,000 stickers, which they were distributing. Their message was very much that the business community is more likely to act than governments are. And one guy who was saying that he was using his skills as a fund manager to try and start an environmental fund at the same time. And then there have just been people walking in off the streets, like normal Londoners who've walked through and seen that this is happening and thought, you know, I'd like to get involved and have a piece of this.
A lot of people have commented on how different police behaviour might have been if this weren't a large group of predominantly white middle-class people.
Yeah, I think it's a valid critique to make. And part of the problem that Extinction Rebellion have had is reaching out beyond that core constituency of white middle-class sort of individuals who don't really have a lot to fear from the police. I mean, they've come under criticism from the left for their strategy of getting as many people arrested as possible, because, you know, you wouldn't be able to ask a group of young black or Muslim men to go and take part in a protest where essentially the goal was for them to get arrested, because actually being arrested holds a lot of fear. You know, if you're a community that's victim of a kind of systematic institutionalized racism by police, I mean, I'm mixed race and I grew up basically being told by my mother to never go anywhere near the police. And if I see the police come in, then I need to turn around and walk away and try and keep as much distance between me and them as possible. But that said, the tactic is working. And the people who are involved in Extinction Rebellion, and I'm not quite sure how I feel about this statement, are saying that we need to use our privilege in order to make the change that, you know, in order to achieve the changes that we want to see. And they say that they're fully aware that they are much less likely to be treated harshly by the police. One of the people I met there was Nabila.
My name is Nabila Kalanzi. I am from Uganda and Egypt, was born in England, therefore
she was,
I am British.
Sitting at a swarming roadblock. So she was one of the few black people I saw in the demonstration.
The one thing that sees no colour is climate change. It is coming for all of us, regardless of where you live or who you are, even though, of course, it will impact people in other areas more so. But at the end of the day, this is all our world, and we have all contributed to this fault. So therefore, it is our duty to take responsibility. And it's also our duty to educate all of us and all around us, and go beyond your circle, go beyond your culture, go beyond your demographic, because that is the only way we can incite real change.
I mean, some people are just perhaps never going to be won over by what Extinction Rebellion are doing. But does that even matter to them?
No, from what I understand, their strategy is they don't feel that they need to convince everybody that action needs to be taken. They have this belief that they only need to convince a certain proportion of the population. What they see is that if there are 3.5% of people who are willing to take radical action to the point of being arrested in order to change things, then that can carry the rest of society with them.
I mean, do you think this is going to be a tipping point for climate change, or is it a flash in the pan?
There's something very interesting that Stokely Carmichael, who is involved with the civil rights movement in the United States, used to say.
We must know clearly the difference between mobilization and organization. One of the characteristics of mobilization is that it is temporary. Organization is permanent and eternal.
And he said, there's a lot of people out there who can mobilize and they can bring lots of numbers of people together and they can take them out on a big demonstration, but there are fewer people who can also organize.
Many brothers and sisters who've been to the Million and More March will say to you, I was there. Well, what are you doing today, my sister? I was there.
And I think actually what Extinction Rebellion have managed to do is they've managed to combine organization with mobilization. Each time they do one of these actions, they gather thousands more volunteers. I think they're onto something with the ways in which that they've approached this protest and the ways in which they've organized it. And I think it may be a tipping point in the public consciousness and understanding of climate change. Whether that can be translated into action on a social, societal, wide level is more difficult to say. There's definitely a tipping point in the nature of protest in the UK.
Dave Miguel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how realistic are Extinction Rebellion's three demands? Welcome back. Just before we crack on, a super quick favour. We've been nominated for two awards at the British Podcast Awards, but there is a third, and it's the people's vote. So if you like what we do here at Today in Focus, then please do go and have a vote for us. Just head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Thanks. Now, Guardian Environment correspondent Matthew Taylor reminds us of Extinction Rebellion's three demands and assesses how realistic they actually are.
For me, they're quite simple and quite neat, and it's not, the onus can't be on an ad hoc protest group to come up with a detailed, specific set of policies to address what is a huge challenge. I think that has to be taken up by scientists, policymakers, and politicians. Extinction Rebellion's first demand is for the government to tell the truth about the scale and seriousness of the climate crisis. The idea of politicians telling the truth, to be honest about the biggest crisis facing this country and indeed the world, doesn't seem a particularly radical or big ask. The second demand is for a citizens' assembly, and that would basically a group of representative members of the public coming together to hear evidence and to come forward with solutions. I think that the idea of a citizens' assembly is a legitimate arguing point. We've argued here at The Guardian that the citizens' assembly should be used for the Brexit debate. The third demand from Extinction Rebellion is for the UK to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2025. Now, this is a huge demand, and most people, most experts think it's highly unlikely to be achieved. Because at the moment, we've got the Climate Change Committee saying that we need to hit 80% by 2050. We've got Extinction Rebellion at the other end now saying we need to get to zero emissions by 2025. But that, by staking out the territory in a wider, more radical area at the 2025 end, it suddenly becomes zero emissions by 2035 or 2040 suddenly becomes the middle ground. So you're changing the territory on which this can be debated. So if we were to try and get to net zero emissions by 2025, it would mean a huge upheaval. We would need to radically transform the way we move around our transport systems from any sort of fossil fuels to electric. We would need to transform our energy systems overnight, our housing energy systems, our industrial energy systems, away from fossil fuels to renewables or potentially nuclear, from eating food that was flown into the UK. So I guess I would argue that this is not about tacking on environmental policies to the existing system and, you know, promoting renewables a bit more. This is about looking systemically at how we organise as a society. We are operating a system which is devouring the planetary resources. Yeah, as an environment correspondent at The Guardian, the job is not without its stresses and anxieties, but in the last week or 10 days, there's almost a strange sense that I'm feeling, which is perhaps a tiny sense of optimism, that things might be changing, not in terms of what is happening, what the hard reality of what politicians and governments are doing, but at least in terms of the awareness of what needs to be done. And I think that's the real achievement of Extinction Rebellion, the school strikes and other movements.
The Guardian has been closely following the protests and the reaction. You can find all of it, films, reports, interviews, photographs, at theguardian.com. That's all for today. My thanks to Damien Gale and Matthew Taylor. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Joshua Kelly and Brenna Daldorf. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.